Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Hi.
Here's John Williams.
I would have voted. Hi, it's John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. It's warm, it's rainy, it's not pretty, but it's not cold. In downtown Chicago, that's all going to change a little bit, but, you know, 30 degrees and 20 degrees ain't 0 degrees, and that was part of our January. I'll take every bit of this. What a weekend we had, temperature-wise, who and Ray. Although the land gets a little muddy on days like these, but that's just the trade you have to make. We'll, in a minute, play for you some of the audio from the Senate floor. The ayes had it, 81 votes, to continue to operate the government for 17 more days in exchange for the pledge that Republicans will negotiate in good faith with Democrats about DACA. So you got 17 days to still get that done, but the government continues to operate. Senator Durbin spoke. They carved out 3 special minutes. Chuck Schumer asked the president of the Senate if Senator Durbin could speak, and Illinois' longstanding minority whip got his words in. But Schumer was interesting because Schumer said things that you know the president didn't like. McConnell did not return the favor. He didn't punch back. But I fully expect some sort of snarky comments from the president on Twitter because he doesn't like being criticized or labeled. And that happened today. We'll get to all of that in just a minute. I do not understand how so many young women, and actually some young men, were able to be assaulted by this Dr. Nasser, this gymnastics doctor who had his way with too many young people for too many years. Do you know the number they say is over 150? Listen to this paragraph in the New York Times on Sunday. The leaders of USA Gymnastics fought to keep the abuse secret. All organizations do, but all organizations are people. How can you in good conscience do that? Michaela Maroney, an Olympic gold medalist, said that she signed a non-disclosure agreement in 2016 and, according to the Wall Street Journal, received $1.25 million from the Federation in exchange for her promise to remain quiet about Dr. Nasser's abuse. The problem is, according to her lawyer, John Manley, that forcing a witness in a felony sexual assault case to remain silent about her abuse might be illegal. Ms. Raisman has also said the Federation prodded her to keep her abuse from the public. Good Lord, people. There's a writer in Indianapolis. His name is Mark Alicia, and he wrote a series called Out of Balance about this. He's going to join us in the 2 o'clock hour. Before I play some of that audio from the Senate floor, hats off to Elif Garris, our producer, and Violetta Podramedic in traffic, who is now not just a person, but Violetta is also an app. You know, there's this thing called Google, and they have an app called Arts and Culture. And the whole country's loved the fact that you can go there, upload a selfie, and then it will automatically, using its biometric engineering, find an artwork that looks exactly like you, a sculpture, but usually a painting on a museum wall. And they have millions to choose from. But since laws in Illinois don't enable the use of biometric data that way, the app literally does not appear on your phone when you download it here in Illinois. Texas is the same way. We decided to do it manually. And by that, I mean I told Violetta to do it manually. So
yeah, it's exhausting being an app.
I can't. There's a sentence for the day.
I mean, I don't have any...
anything else to do with your free time?
Yeah. It's like all I'm doing is just, I feel like a stalker too. I'm on the Google, you know, typing in all this crazy stuff to match our listeners with their perfect portraits.
You really have done, this is why I keep bugging you about this. You're doing it so well.
Thank you.
The guy with the blue-green beard. Oh, my God.
That was very lucky that I found that.
He's got a ZZ Top-like beard. That's blue-green. It's kind of an aqua color.
Mm-hmm.
And there it is, the painting of him hanging on a wall. I mean, it's amazing. There's 2 nice things about what we're doing here. And by the way, if you like me on Facebook, I'm King John on Facebook. You can upload your picture. It couldn't be simpler. And then Violetta will, in theory,
using geometric face recognition.
Yes, Violetic face recognition. Mm-hmm. She goes and finds one, and we post them side by side. LF does that part, and it's really been fun. So the two things about it are, A, it's so nice to see who you are. You want to see what GN listeners look like? You're an interesting, good-looking bunch. Number two, it's laugh-out-loud funny how accurate or sometimes inaccurate, but capturing the essence they are. They either look very much like, or they're not an exact match, but they have the same vibe or feel. So kudos to you and Elif. You guys are doing a great job. Please keep it up and show us who you are on Facebook. The closer the picture, the better. Some of your shots are a little distant, and then we don't see you. Are you going to do the dog, Violetta? Somebody sent us a picture of a dog.
Yeah, I did. I did the dog. I found a nice golden retriever, and this golden retriever looks a little mad.
Okay.
So I found the same essence, like you said, the vibe of the picture. Some golden retrievers, a lot of the paintings were very go lucky. This dog looked intense, and I found that intensity.
You see what I'm talking about? She doesn't take this responsibility lightly. You're listening to WGN Radio, and on Facebook, I'm King John. We'd love for you to look and play along. Thank you for your pictures. Thank you for your pictures. On the Senate floor today, Senator Chuck Schumer got to speak in advance of the vote to continue the operation of the government and delay the vote on DACA, which is what Democrats were holding out for and which delayed the operation of the government for a couple of days. Schumer didn't pull any punches. He said that Republicans are in charge of both parties, you know.
Today, we enter the third day of the Trump shutdown, the first ever real shutdown to occur when one party controls the entire legislative process.
Now, remember, Chuck Schumer met with the president late last week. He spoke briefly about that meeting and also then gave the president his own label.
My recent offer to the president was a generous one. I put his signature campaign issue on the table in exchange for DACA, and still, he turned away. President Trump's unwillingness to compromise caused the Trump shutdown and brought us to this moment.
The Trump shutdown, he called it. He spoke to the president almost directly a couple of times.
The great deal-making president sat on the sidelines.
And then he spoke right at the president with this one.
We will vote today to reopen the government, to continue negotiating a global agreement with the commitment that if an agreement isn't reached by February the 8th, the Senate will immediately proceed to consideration of legislation dealing with DACA.
Pardon me, that's him laying the plan out. That is 17 days, February 8th. Let's get this thing done. That gives us time to do DACA. If not, we'll be back where we started. This is a temporary continuation. And then this line, one more time. You know the president is watching, so Schumer does this.
Now, it's a shame, Mr. President, that the American people and the Senate have had to endure such hand-wringing, finger-pointing stridency.
Schumer took one more shot at the president.
The bipartisan group, in a very fine way, filled the glaring absence of the president in these talks.
Yeah, I'm going on the Twitter right now and typing in D-O-N. That pre-populates Donald Trump for me, and I'll see if he's shot back. Schumer concluded with this. Democrats have been reasonable, he said. It was the president that wasn't.
Through these complicated and lengthy negotiations, Democrats have always sought to be reasonable, to act in good faith, and get something real done. Despite all of our entreaties, the president was obstinate.
It's funny because Donald Trump has been eerily quiet on the Twitter Sunday and today Monday, which is not a bad thing, but you were wondering if he would not participate more, either as a cheerleader or as an antagonist or as a commentator. And he wasn't any of those much over the weekend, not like he usually is and not like you would have expected here. So Schumer takes all those shots at the president. Here at the great moment of compromise, he's going to get his last digs in. Then Mitch McConnell comes up. And after having heard all of that about Republicans and the president, McConnell's first words are,
I want to thank the Democratic leader for his comments.
I'll bet you do. And then he sort of pulled his punch.
I think if we've learned anything during this process, it's that a strategy to shut down the government over the issue of illegal immigration is something the American people didn't understand.
And we didn't understand it. We know we didn't like it, but he didn't join the fray, Mitch McConnell. He led it at that. But then Schumer said, can Dick Durbin speak for just a couple of minutes? Literally, he asked for three. And in part, Dick Durbin, our own Illinois senator, framed the issue this way.
The issue of immigration, the issue of the Dreamers, is the civil rights issue of our time.
He was encouraged by the process of the last few weeks.
What I have seen here on the floor of the Senate in the last few days is something we have not seen for years. Constructive, bipartisan conversations and dialogue on the floor, not just about this issue, which is obviously front and center, but about the future of this institution. That, to me, has been encouraging.
Encouraged by what he's seen in the last few days, and that is, I guess, their ability to come together to this point. But it's not done yet. This is Dick Durbin's career signature effort. This will define his career. He's been working on this for years. He's the minority whip. And now it's all going to come down to something in 17 days that they promised him. So he's sort of calling them out on this now. He is laying his foundation of hope that they're going to be good for truly constructive talks.
Now comes the test, the real test, as to whether we can get this done, whether we can be the Senate again, whether we can return to a regular order on the floor and constructively have a debate. For some of you, it'll be the first time you've ever seen it. But believe me, it's worth the price of admission.
He's positively cheering them on to, when it's his turn now, to, if not give him what he wants, give him a fair hearing. He spoke about it this way.
I want to thank Senator McConnell for explicitly saying today it will be a level playing field. It will be open to both sides.
That's what it, I mean, because when we visited with one of the ABC reporters last week, she said, well, the trade would be give us the funding, pass this bill, and then we promise that we'll go ahead and give you the DACA, at least conversation that you want to have. I said, well, do they trust him? But this agreement today sort of makes the need for trusting the other side moot because there's a 17-day deadline. The clock is ticking. So trust him or not, the proof will be in the pudding. What happens between now and the 8th? As he left, Senator Durbin had one more comment, and that was for the Dreamers themselves.
To all the Dreamers who are watching today, don't give up. I know that your lives are hanging in the balance on what we do here on Capitol Hill and with the White House.
So that's where we are today. At least that's the way I read it, Steve. Do you have any other news observations about this?
Not so much. We're waiting for the House to vote, and then the president's going to speak. So when he does, we'll pick up a little bit of that. Sarah Sanders is giving the briefing now and saying pretty much that the plan that was approved today was the plan that the president has been behind in proposing all along. So we'll see where that goes.
Well, hopefully the Republicans and the obstructionist losers will be able to hammer something out here, because this is, you know, when they say kicking the can down the road, it's usually a bad thing. Maybe this is not, but this is literally kicking the can down the road.
It's not even the road. It's the driveway.
It's a very short tour. Yeah. We're going to be right here and we're going to kick it just to there. And I think what happened, I mean, think about it. This is constructive for all in that you need to get two things done. You got to get the budget passed and you've got to finally, once and for all, resolve DACA. The Democrats walked out on Friday, or shut the government down Friday night at midnight. So Saturday and Sunday, when not a lot happens, you didn't miss the federal government over the weekend, did you? Probably not. And now we're back open for business on Monday. But they've showed their resolve. They will shut this baby down if they don't get what they want. If you wanted a dry run of the consequences, there it was. And so that's where we are today.
So you see this as a warning shot that, and next time there'll be more resolute?
Yeah, I do. I do. Okay. I mean, I don't know how else to interpret it. I think that's an optimistic interpretation. That's my view of what happened today. So that's that. Brendan and I went to Lincoln Square to the Davis Theater and saw the Post, the story of the Pentagon Papers over the weekend. Steve, there was applause at the end of that movie. Have you seen The Post yet?
I have not.
Tom Hanks is so good. And that other gal that was in the movie with her, she's pretty good too. Good grief, what a film. And you know, I was worried that it's not historically accurate entirely and the timeline is messed up to suggest some things. They close, the last scene is of the Watergate burglars breaking in, and that's not how it all went down, but that's okay. I think mostly, in fact, really all this movie is trying to be about is the conflict between the government and the First Amendment and the freedom of the press. You know, it's also interesting, which is how they make, literally, or did then, a newspaper. You know, literally how they sort of how the printing presses work. I'm fascinated by that stuff. It's so much meticulous detail. And I suppose it's a little more automated now, but Brendan and I have seen most of the major movies. I've been telling you that I thought really the best movie I may have seen this year was Three Billboards, and I think I'm going to stick with that. But I'll put this one right up there. This is really a terrific movie. The last two times we've seen a movie, though, in order to buy our ticket, you go online, and you not only buy your ticket, you reserve your seat. Is that the way we want to buy movie tickets now?
No.
Because if you showed up going, hey, the Post is showing at the Davis, let's go over. You swing by, you stand in line. Not only is it, you know, say it's not sold out, but that you got there early doesn't help. We bought our tickets online for whatever seats we want. So you either can't get in or you can get in, but all of the good seats will always be taken no matter how diligent you are about arriving early.
My family doesn't like to go to the movies with me anymore because that's all I do is complain about it.
And
because,
well, you weren't earlier than the other people who bought them online.
Because
hours or days in advance.
Because
here's
going to a movie should be, you know, sort of, hey, let's go to a movie.
Yeah, right.
And then you go. And you can't do that now. You've got to plan the movie.
You've got to
choose the movie.
Yeah.
You've got to pick your seats or you can't do it. And it's just, I don't like the way that's...
I never knew you were so spontaneous, Steve.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, now the seats, they've changed it to put these recliners in, so there are 30 seats in a theater, not 150 uncomfortable seats where
that
you could
too.
Always get one.
That too. And we're sitting there with a beer and a wine.
Yeah, well.
I ordered a red wine. They handed me a can. They go, here's your beer. I go, there's wine in here? Yep. That's fine. So the government is back in business. We spoke about that in the first half hour. We'll continue to follow that. And the president's going to talk about that a little later on. You will hear that here on WGN Radio. Also testifying today, giving impact statements, if you will, are members of the U.S. Olympic gymnastics team and others. That story is just stunning to me. I mean, I have not been paying that much attention to it, to be honest with you. There's been so many things to follow, but it just keeps coming and coming and coming. More and more young ladies stepping up, and some of the revelations are just shocking. Almost not so much for what that one guy did, Dr. Was it Rassman? But Nasser.
Nasser.
That's Rassman spelled sideways. Nasser. But for what everybody else was complicit in doing. The cover-up is just stunning.
A couple of members of USA Gymnastics resigned today, too, or maybe three, I saw, out of Indianapolis. You know, it is interesting that this isn't on everyone's lips or, you know, the front burner. I'm not a big girls' Olympics follower, but that's the biggest sport of the Winter Olympics, right?
Yeah, sure.
And these are the women who competed for the U.S. and were American
summer.
Darlings.
Yeah.
Summer, I'm sorry. You know, and now talking about how they were molested with a doctor from the Olympic organization. I mean, it's an amazing thing.
And then you see them put that smile on their face. You know, we require our female athletes particularly to not only do the impossible on the mat and in the ice, but do so while being pretty and smiling and knowing what they had to go through to get there. And in fact, that's the guy that will tend to them if they get injured. I mean, it's just insane. I don't know how well these women will recover, and some of them say not easily. Well, anyway, there's a guy who has been writing about this in the Indianapolis Star. His series on it was Off Balance. Amen to that. Out of Balance. Thank you, Elif. And he'll join us in the 2 o'clock hour. I tweeted over the weekend. If you follow me on the Twitter, I'm WGN King John. WGN King John on Twitter. And I tweeted, we have interviewed three of the top six New York Times bestselling authors of late. Most compelling, not a top 15 yet, but at number 250 on Amazon, is Christian Piccolini's book, White American Youth. And then there's a link to it. If you want to know more or if you want to order the book, you can link right to my to Amazon through my Twitter account. Here are the top six books, by the way. Fire and Fury, the Michael Wolff book, is once again number one on the New York Times, the story about Donald Trump's White House. Number two, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry by Neil deGrasse Tyson. He was in our studio. What a great interview he was. That's number two. Leonardo da Vinci by Walter Isaacson. He visited with us a couple of times. He's number three. The Da Vinci book is just, it's a beautiful book and it's a well-told story. Number four, Ron Chernow's Grant, about President Grant. Number five is Promise Me Dad by Joe Biden. Let Trump Be Trump by Corey Lewandowski is number six. Corey was infamously on this show a few weeks ago. There's your top six, three of them either in the studio or on the phone. And none of the books as easy to put down, as hard to put down, is White American Youth by Chicago's Christian Piccolini about the white Nazi youth movement in the Chicago area. Here's the author's note to that Fire and Fury by Michael Wolff in the beginning. And, you know, look, everybody's wondering how much of this is true or not. And if you we all agree that it's not all true, the maddening part is to try and figure out which is which. About some of that, he says this: the events I've described in these pages are based on conversations that took place over a period of 18 months with the president, with most members of his senior staff, and some who talked to me dozens of times. He says, shortly after January 20th, I took up something like a semi-permanent seat on a couch in the West Wing. You may have wondered, how is it that all these other reporters didn't, for whatever reason, have the access, the inside, the dish that he does? And he said that since the White House and the campaign under Donald Trump were so poorly managed, he writes, quote, there was no one to say go away. You know, Lewandowski's in, Lewandowski's out. Manafort's in, Manafort's out. Priebus is in, Priebus is out. Spicer's in and out. And so maybe by the time somebody figured, that guy's not supposed to be here, there'd be somebody else. So he was able to sort of get away with it. He embedded himself because they didn't have their act together. He says, many of the accounts of what has happened in the Trump White House are untrue. This is him writing about his own book. Many of the accounts of what has happened are untrue. He said, there's an elemental thread in this book. Sometimes I have let the players offer their versions, in turn allowing the reader to judge them. In other instances, I have settled on versions of events that I believe to be true. So that's him telling you, read it with a grain of salt. Now, I've only read about 50 pages of the book over the weekend. The first 30 and then another 20 later on. But I'll say this about it. So I've read a sixth of the book so far. It doesn't feel as scandalous or salacious. It feels true to me, which is maybe the best you can hope for a book like this. I'm interested in what the first family's life is like. And he writes this: Donald Trump's marriage was perplexing to almost everybody around him, or it was anyway for those without private jets and many homes. He and Melania spent relatively little time together. They could go days at a time without contact, even when they were both in Trump Tower. Often she did not know where he was or take much notice of that fact. Her husband moved between residents as he would between rooms. Along with knowing little about his whereabouts, she knew little about his business and took at best modest interest in it. An absentee father for his first four children, Trump was even more absent for his fifth baron, his son with Melania. Now on his third marriage, he told friends he thought he had finally perfected the art Live and let live. Do your own thing, he said. Still, the notion that this was a marriage in name only was far from true. He spoke of Melania frequently when she was not there. He admired her looks, often awkwardly for her, in the presence of others. She was, he told people proudly and without irony, a trophy wife. A happy wife is a happy life, he said, echoing a popular rich man truism. Melania was one of the few who thought it was possible that he could win. It was a punchline for his daughter, Ivanka, who had carefully distanced herself from the campaign. With a never-too-hidden distaste for her stepmother, Ivanka would say to friends, "All you have to know about Melania is she thinks if he runs, he'll certainly win." But the prospect of her husband's actually becoming president was for Melania a horrifying one. She believed it would destroy her carefully sheltered life, one sheltered not inconsiderably from the extended Trump family, which was almost entirely focused on her young son. I suspect that it all is true. That sounds about right. But then he gets elected. Wolf writes this. "We can make this work," is what everybody in the Trump orbit was suddenly saying. None of them thought he was going to win. He didn't think he was going to win. Kellyanne Conway was ready for cable TV. Trump was ready for his own cable network, right? So then he gets elected. So Wolf writes this. "We can make this work," is what everybody in the Trump orbit was suddenly saying. Or at the very least, this could possibly work now that he's in office. In fact, up close, Trump was not the bombastic and pugilistic man who had stirred rabid crowds on the campaign trail. He was neither angry nor combative. He may have been the most threatening and frightening and menacing presidential candidate in modern history, but in person he could seem almost soothing. His extreme self-satisfaction rubbed off. Life was sunny. Trump was an optimist, at least about himself. He was charming and full of flattery. He focused on you. He was funny, self-deprecating even, and incredibly energetic. "Let's do it. Whatever it is, let's do it." He wasn't a tough guy. He was a big, warm-hearted monkey, said Bannon with rather faint praise. But, Wolf also writes, almost all the professionals who are now set to join him were coming face to face with the fact that it appeared he knew nothing. There was simply no subject other than perhaps building construction that he was substantially mastered in. Everything with him was off the cuff. Whatever he knew, he seemed to have learned an hour before, and that was mostly half-baked. He offered something obviously. Indeed, while everybody in his rich guy social circle knew about his wide-ranging ignorance, Trump, the businessman, could not even read a balance sheet. And Trump, who had campaigned on his deal-making skills, was, with his inattention to details, a terrible negotiator. They yet found him somehow instinctive. That was the word. He was a force of personality. He could make you believe. And finally, Wolf says this, trying to explain Trump's virtues and his attraction. Piers Morgan, the British newspaper man and ill-fated CNN anchor, said it was all in Trump's book, The Art of the Deal. Everything that made Trump, Trump, that defined his savvy, energy, and charisma was right there. If you wanted to know it, read the book. But Trump had not written The Art of the Deal. His co-writer, Tony Schwartz, insisted that he hardly contributed to it and might not even have read all of it. And that was perhaps the point. Trump wasn't a writer. He was a character, a protagonist, a hero, writes Michael Wolff in Fire and Fury. But doesn't that sound fair? And doesn't that sound about right about Donald Trump in that book? He was weirdly quiet this weekend. Steve, do you know what time the president is supposed to speak to us today about the Senate deal?
No, I would imagine it won't happen until after the House votes. The Senate vote that got all the attention was the procedural one that cleared the way for a final vote. So the actual final Senate vote, I don't think, has occurred yet. That's got to happen. Then the House will vote, and then we'll probably hear from them. Now, Sarah Sanders did talk to reporters, and there was a statement from the president saying he was happy that the Congress came to its senses, and also saying that he would only support an immigration bill coming up that is, quote-unquote, good for our country. So as part of this whole deal, is, you know, the assurance that if not passed, the DACA students or people will be considered before this resolution expires, what, February 8th. So, you know, we'll see if they're able to get that approved before February 8th, if the president will go along with that, or if we just revisit all of this in a few weeks.
Right, we'll be right back where we started if Dick Durbin doesn't get what he wants. By the way, so they have this procedural vote that you just now described?
Yes.
I was amused. Hey, Elif. Elif! So I want to play the audio of the Senate beginning the vote with this procedural announcement. This is parliamentary procedure.
Okay.
You know how they bang the gavel and they now say, well, now, instead of saying, hey, everybody, what are we going to do with this continuing resolution DACA thing?
Signy die, or whatever.
I know. Yeah, thumbs up if you want it and thumbs down if you don't. But that's not how they put it. Are you ready to play it? Here's how they put it.
By unanimous consent, the mandatory quorum call has been waived. The question is it the sense of the Senate that debate on the motion to concur in the House amendment to the Senate amendment to H.R. 195 with a further amendment shall be brought to a close?
Well, yeah.
So if they had said, okay, so which way are you? I would go, I'm sorry, I don't know. I know what I want. I don't know what the answer to that question is. Play it again, Elif. Here's what they voted on today.
By unanimous consent, the mandatory quorum call has been waived. The question is it the sense of the Senate that debate on the motion to concur in the House amendment to the Senate amendment to H.R. 195 with a further amendment shall be brought to a close?
It's someone's job to understand that.
I know, you know, the adults in that room are always at the desk up there with the microphones,
right,
and
right,
the computer, and they're like, trust us, we got this, guys, we know what's going on, just tell us if you're in or you're out, and we'll make it happen.
It is an amazing thing, you know, because most polling shows, I mean, I've seen 78-80% of Americans support doing something for these dreamers, and yet we shut the government down over it. It's a weird situation we're in.
Well, I'm not sure what the Senate is supposed to do vis-a-vis what the people want, quote unquote, because while most people want this resolved, most people did not want the government to shut down over it either.
No, but I mean, just that we're here, because I mean, the president said he wants a bill made of love, a love bill.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, it's like everyone, they don't want to admit to each other that they agree to do something, but everyone seems to be on the side of fixing this particular problem. No one's just doing it.
I was happy to see the behavior, literally the comportment of them. I watched it on TV today, this vote, or on CNN. I watched it online. And, you know, the way they talk, you'd think they'd be screaming at each other and throwing spitballs. And they're shaking hands and patting each other on the back. And it looks like a cordial, intelligent, deliberative group of people. We should watch or listen to that stuff more.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Hi there.
Here's John Williams.
Like me on Facebook. Be part of the Facebook parade of faces that match paintings in museums that we're posting for you. Give us your picture. We'll find your art that matches you. It's fun. You could use it any way you want. We're having a lot of fun with that on my Facebook page. I'm King John there, and on Twitter, I'm WGN. King John, WGN King John, to follow me on Twitter. Sam Panionovich is going to come in. He usually does on Mondays to talk a little sports with us. There he is, walking by the Showcase studio window now. I don't know what my problem is, Steve. I've been interested in the placing of these red light cameras on Michigan Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have them at Jackson, south of the river, and the north of the river at Ontario. So busy Michigan Avenue, where people use traffic lights as a guideline, is now going to be issuing $100 tickets for people who break the plane when it's red. Oh, my God. All of our financial problems are solved.
Well,
that is going to be a freaking cash register.
Because people are going to inch into it when it's...
Tourists, cab drivers, Uber drivers who don't have a clue, people that are distracted because it's Michigan Avenue, people that are frustrated because it was gridlocked and now they're going to assert their turn and they break the plane. It's
right.
Just going to... I'll
it's
bet...
Not a, it's not... These aren't the sorts of lights where people run them, right? If that's the worry, you're going to run them and get in an accident. This is where you creep into it after it's yellow maybe or something.
I know. And I don't know why I'm against this, but for some reason I am. I'm against putting them there. This is not, to me, the intended purpose of these things. It's not fixing the problem that we have elsewhere.
Well, that was kind of what I was trying to say.
Crashes and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it's illegal to cross on a red light.
you know, blah, 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 across the red line, blah, blah, blah. No, you're absolutely right, Violetta. And why would I defend that? Because gridlock is such a hassle.
Right. And I think people are probably going to get a lot of first-time tickets. And then after that, I don't think you're going to inch forward anymore. You might learn your lesson.
Yeah.
Remember when they had traffic cops in the intersections?
Yep.
Would make a huge difference in traffic going either out on Ontario or in Ohio during the rush hours.
Ohio is the disaster of the city.
They're so scary, though, traffic guards.
Why do you say that?
They just scare me with their whistles and their batons, and you're always in the wrong spot. Go, go, stop, no, go.
Oh, yeah, they are loud, and they are angry. But the criticism I hear is that a lot of times they're just not doing it as well as it should be done.
But they used to be, during rush hours, they would be stationed all along those routes, LaSalle and Ontario and things.
They should totally be all the way to the Ohio Street Feeder.
I think it's a money thing. They've been gone for a long time now.
I mean, think about it. Those cost money. This makes money. So there you are. And that's at the root of my problem. I don't know that this is going to fix it as much as it's just going to ring the register. So, and I'll probably be getting one of them. And I don't want to do that. You know, for instance, how they're taking down. Mary Schmeek had a really good column in the Chicago Tribune over the weekend about the Crate and Barrel Anchor Store on Michigan Avenue. Just a stone's throw from where we are. In fact, very near the intersection. It might be. Is that Crate and Barrel at Michigan and Ontario? It's right around there.
It might be at Ohio.
Is that Ohio? Here's the point, that the Starbucks on Michigan Avenue are some of the most profitable Starbucks on earth. In fact, I think the one opposite us across Michigan Avenue and just down a few buildings was the most profitable per square foot Starbucks on earth.
They're welcome.
You betcha. There are three next to each other right here. And now they're going to put a giant Starbucks where that Crate and Barrel is?
But I don't think it'll hurt their business.
I care about the fabric of Michigan Avenue. I want interesting stores. I want better, more affordable, more accessible restaurants on Michigan Avenue. I'd like some nice retail on Michigan Avenue. A Starbucks? Every Starbucks is excessive by definition. They're too expensive. They've got too many options. The lines are too long. And now we're going to say, well, let's quintuple that. Let's make a really big one of those.
They're
going to
gazookle it. It'll be a lot more than quintuple.
It'll be the gazookle of it.
But I don't remember who it was or where it was, but they have one of these now. Maybe it's in Seattle. And someone who I know was there and said, wait till it comes to Michigan Avenue.
Why?
It's going to be a meeting ground.
It's great. They're supposed to be great.
Yeah. You know what? I hope you guys are right.
And listen, you're going to need some coffee if you're going to go shopping on all those other stores on that street.
Problem
you
is,
fuel.
We have less places to shop. Crate and Barrel was a fun store. I know that the problem was people don't want to lug plates around Michigan Avenue when they come out of there. I don't know what the solution is, but while maybe that store is not viable there, a Starbucks. But Steve, you're right. Shame on me for judging in advance.
Well, I do.
Maybe it'll be swell.
There was someone who was at one, and they said it's a really cool thing.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Eataly, right? You don't have a problem with Eataly.
I don't exactly understand Eataly either, to be honest with you. But no, Eataly is retail, and it's fun, and it's popular, so thumbs up to Eataly. But Eataly is the Disneyfication of the Italian food industry, and I guess I don't like the whole Disney treatment of things. Maybe that's my problem.
It's the happiest place on earth.
They have a really cool coffee grinding ride you go through.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, like, are you just like, ooh, yeah, but they'll have a coffee grinder. Hooray! Come on, kids, let's go to Chicago. No, that's not what you're going to do. Sam Panionovich is in our studio from WGN Sports. Go.
I haven't had a cup of coffee since 2009.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
One in my entire life. I didn't like it.
What?
Don't drink it, don't like it, don't want to smell it.
I didn't like coffee the first 100 cups I had, but I came around.
I was interning at Channel 2 television. I was 19, and I had to get up at 3 in the morning. And the one morning, I didn't sleep at all. So I thought, I'm going to try this coffee thing, see what it's all about.
Yeah.
Couldn't stand it.
So I got to make you a Turkish coffee with some whipped cream.
Pass. I'll take a $5 Rice Krispie treat, though, at Starbucks.
No.
Yeah. Good luck. Yeah, I mean, enjoy. So what is your caffeine fix in the morning?
I don't do it.
You wake up and you go, hey, I'm Sam Panionovich, and boom, you go.
I don't exactly do that. I just wake up and roll out of bed, and that's it.
Because some mornings I wake up and go, I'm Sam Panionovich, and off I go. It works. Try it sometime.
Okay.
First 100 times I had coffee, I don't think I enjoyed it much. But I was dating a woman who was really a coffee drinker. I loved her to pieces, so I started drinking coffee. And I married that gal.
Woo!
And 1,000 cups of coffee later.
Congrats.
I have one in my hand right now.
Not to compare coffee and beer at all, but it's the same thing with beer.
Same thing.
Because when you first try beer, you're like, ugh.
This is that? Hey, try gin with olives floating in there. Nobody the first time thought, ooh, hey, that's a good idea. But, you know, it's that way with all our good and bad habits. Tobacco. Does anybody remember the first puff and thought, ooh, I want to do this all the time? But you learn to do it. Sam, what happened to the playoffs this weekend? Did you think that the New England Patriots game was going to be that good?
I picked the Jags to win.
Well, they almost did.
We're going to win.
You were feeling good about that game.
I thought Jacksonville's defense was real. The issue is when you go away from everything you've done in the entire first half, this is how Tom Brady hangs on. You do everything well in the first half. You're aggressive. You're throwing the ball down the field. You're hitting him in the mouth, playing real physical football. And then you get a 10-point lead, and you're just trying to slow the game down and run clock. And you almost play not to lose rather than play to win. And if you give Tom Brady just a snippet of daylight, this man has proven he'll rip your heart out, man.
Meanwhile, Nine Fingers, as we like to call him, then goes, okay, I've got to play aggressive. I've got to get the job done. And boy, he does. Which finger was suspect?
It was right under the thumb on his right hand. It was taped pretty much under the begin where the thumb starts to shoot up. That's where the tape was. It was ripped around the... One of his teammates actually hit him in practice unintentionally, and it busted everything open, and he had, I think, 10 stitches on his thumb. But
no kidding.
Didn't affect his play at all. I'll tell you what, all the big plays...
Is that on his throwing hand?
On his throwing hand. Wow. Yeah, he had black tape on his hand.
Yeah.
Didn't affect him at all. All the big plays that needed to happen went New England's way. Now, I'm not going to blame the officials. New England only had one penalty. Say what you want about that. But all the big throws, 3rd and 18.
Yeah.
He makes that dart throw to Amendola.
Shame on them.
The passes he drops in, and, you know, 4th downs, they're going for it. They're getting them. All the big plays New England made. And Jacksonville just didn't.
Still, didn't you think it was a little suspect? After the game, the official rips off his jersey and has a New England Patriots T-shirt on underneath.
Did you see the one official as the two teams were converging near center field?
Okay, I made that up if you're wondering, but keep
going. Right, you made that one up. So they're coming toward the center of the field, and Tom was shaking hands with one of the Jaguars, and one of the officials walked up to Tom and just patted him on the back.
Patted him on the back, yeah. And then I saw another picture of that same guy or another official kind of palling around and smiling with some of the Patriots.
After a touchdown. He was in the middle of the pile.
What was your reaction to that? Partisanship on the officials.
I don't blame the officials for anything because, let me be clear, the officials suck in every sport. It's just ironic that the benefit of the doubt always ends up on the side of New England. One penalty for 10 yards. Jacksonville had 6 for 100. One of those penalties goes a different way, we could have a different game. The penalty on the pass interference down the field, this is after they knocked Gronk out of the game, which I agreed with. There was a helmet-to-helmet hit. Gronk came out with a concussion. It was a boom-boom play. Barry Church hit Gronk. That was a flag. The very next play, Brady throws the ball about 40 yards. It's not catchable, but the defender and the receiver were sort of had their hands all over each other, and they call the flag, and they throw PI. That one I didn't agree with, but to say the officials helped the Pats win, that's too far-fetched.
If I'm an official, and I am, by the way, Steve, you're talking to me in my ear if you intend to do that. Steve, I'm hearing you in my ear. If the officials...
It's kind of like how Brady hears the officials in his ear.
I know. I'm cupping my ear right now and seeing what the play is that they're about to
call. Tom, fall down. Tom, when you get hit, fall.
If I was an official, though, and I was an integral part of a championship game, and I get to tell my kids I called the game that Tom Brady sent him to his 8th of six of the last 16 Super Bowls. I mean, it's just incredible. He wasn't exactly celebrating as much as he was congratulating one of the greatest players ever. I don't mind him doing that.
There were no ifs, ands, or buts about the first half. Nobody asked anybody or nobody talked about, you know, cheating by the officials in the first half. It's only when New England wins. When they win, everybody cries cheating. Everybody cries this and that. The Jaguars lost to the best quarterback that's ever played.
So after the game, though, you see Belichick, and he's so happy and animated. And I'm like, how can you be so happy and animated? This cannot be that special to you. It would have been special to the other team. This is no reason for him to lose, but I'm not buying the theater of him anyway. Then you go to the Vikings game. which was supposed to be a pretty good game.
One of the biggest no-shows ever.
Would you put it that way?
Yeah. A chance to go play at home in the Super Bowl, and their fans were so arrogant and cocky. They were. This game wasn't even going to be close, if you asked a Minnesota fan, because it's Nick Foles, right? Carson Wentz, the MVP candidate, goes down. Oh, well, it's Nick Foles. He's no good. Minnesota, I'm not going to say they overlooked Philadelphia, well, but they were not ready for what they saw yesterday.
They had a no-name quarterback, too.
Case Keenum, who looked like Case Keenum.
Meaning?
He looked like an average quarterback.
Yeah.
He was playing above his means, I think, for the last couple of weeks.
How does the coach not have the team more prepared than that? I mean, is that on the coaches or the management of the Vikings?
It's both. It's on coaches, but it's also on execution. I mean, their defensive players were just a second late on a couple of those deep throws. You know, 1 second is everything. 1 second is the difference between me tipping a pass and me letting that pass go over my hand and be caught for a touchdown. So execution-wise, that's always first and foremost in sports. We can blame coaches and we can blame officials. It's the players that go out there and make plays. And Minnesota... they made one play. It was the first drive of the game. They went up 7-0. Then they were outscored 38-0. They didn't score again after that first drive. That is not on coaching.
What was the line on the game, Mr. Chicken Dinner?
Minnesota was favored by 3. We took the Eagles. We did. We took the Eagles, and we took the Jags to win the game. Could have been 2-0.
Yeah, you're 1-1.
I was aggressive. I could have taken the 7, but I really thought Jacksonville was going to win.
And you didn't think that Minnesota was going to win by... No, you wouldn't give up 3 points for Minnesota.
I thought the Eagles were going to win just going away.
No kidding.
Yeah, I thought they were going to win. I didn't think they'd win by 31.
Was that it? Was it 31?
38-7 was the final.
Oh, well, if you take 38 and subtract 7, that's 31.
You almost spilled your coffee. Yeah, that would have been
really bad. Right into the electronic equipment here at WGN
Radio.
That would have
been fantastic. Okay. The issue is, when you get a number one seed, they're the number one seed... in the NFC, right?
Yeah.
And everybody has counted them out since they've been in the playoffs. All the papers, national, local, not giving this team a chance. That'll put a chip on your shoulder. That's why I thought coming in, they embraced the underdog role extremely well, and that's why they're going to the Super Bowl.
I believe now that Minnesota is going to host the Super Bowl, they have, I believe the number is 10,000 people who are working or volunteering to make the Super Bowl happen. Minnesota has an expression called Minnesota Nice. They like to think that they're the most welcoming, friendly, nice people on earth. Minnesota Nice. Minnesota Nice. So we are going to see just how nice and accommodating Minnesotans are.
You betcha.
Because it's going to be really hard to roll out the welcome mat to the people that were mocking their skull chant.
Go Eagles! Please!
It's funny, you know, you tell people to post their pictures, and by golly, they post their pictures. Violetta, you'll have your work cut out for you.
I might start charging for the app.
You know, we could. Some of them are 99 cents. Some of them are $1.99. Some of them are $100. Most apps are free.
And when you say we,
I mean,
are we splitting that 99?
Oh, sure. Listen, if we can get somebody to give us a buck, I'll give you every penny of it. Here's what we're doing. Since that app that Google has doesn't work in Illinois, our laws are different here. You can't go online with their app and actually have them find the picture that matches your face. But if you send us a selfie, we'll find a work of art somewhere in the world that looks just like you. And it's amazing what a good job Violetta is doing on this. I mentioned that earlier, so a bunch of you have uploaded your pictures to my Facebook page. I'm King John on Facebook.
They just keep pouring in, John.
Some of you, somebody sent their dog. Violetta found a match for that. I'm telling you, the guy with the beard, I don't know who you would say is winning, but the guy with the beard is really hilarious.
Well, I wanted to make sure that I made that a good one because he said challenge mode, as if we couldn't find a picture. And I, you know,
found a picture. Holidays bring the new year. The holidays have come and gone. The new year is here. We're 3 weeks into 2018, and it's not too late for you to get one of those personalized calendars that we make with our friends from 2Ks. Here's what you do. Go to WGNradio.com. Scroll down to the featured section. Click that button, and there you'll see everything you need to know about how to get a personalized calendar. It's 12 great pictures, one each month of our city. They are new pictures, and incorporated into each photo will be this digital technology that incorporates the name you ask into the ironwork or the brickwork or the clouds or the bubbles in the water. It's amazing what they can do. They look so realistic. And don't get these for the personalization. If nothing else, get them because you need a calendar. And these are beautiful Chicago calendars. WGNRadio.com. Scroll down to the featured section there. It's 2:26. So we've been talking on and off a little bit about the gymnastics doctor who was abusing these young women for years. The impact statements continue. A reporter that's been following that in Indianapolis will join us after the news. All right, I got my browser up now. My computer just loaded, Violetta, so let me go to the John Williams page. You said a lot more people have...
Yeah, a lot are trickling in. You know, it's just like when I think my work is done.
Yeah, I know. Because Elif, then after you do them, Elif then posts them again. She, you know, you find the matches, and then Elif gets them up here. Yeah, one guy put... This poor guy, David Okar, his picture of him with the Vikings logo. That's probably not his favorite picture right now. U.S. gymnast Kyle Stevens commenting on the impact that the Olympic doctor had on her said this.
After my parents confronted you, they brought you back to my house to speak with me. Sitting on my living room couch, I listened to you tell me, no one should ever do that. And if they do, you should tell someone. Well, Larry, I'm here. Not to tell someone, but to tell everyone. You convinced my parents that I was a liar.
That's Kyle Stevens talking directly to Larry Nassar, the longtime national team doctor for the United States Olympic program. Writing about this in the Indianapolis Star, the series was called Out of Balance, is Mark Alicia, sports business reporter at the Indy Star. You can read his work, you know, a variety of ways, certainly at IndyStar.com. Mark, it's John Williams, and you're on WGN Radio in Chicago. How are you today?
Doing well. Good afternoon.
This is insane. Is while we are all coming to grips with this, is the gymnastic community just coming to grips with this too? Did nobody know? Was this that well kept a secret?
Well, the abuse from Dr. Nassar started about 23 years ago, and he was a master con man, a beloved man. He was recognized as the foremost gymnastics doctor in the country. He was the go-to guy. He was revered in his community. And he was nice to all these girls. And they've testified the last week and today that they made him feel, or he made them feel right away as if they were the most important people in the world. And in gymnastics, there's kind of what we've found was there's a culture of silence that we hope will start to change. But I mean, there were some people who reported him before our story sort of broke this open in September 2016. There were reports to a gymnastics coach at Michigan State University who was very close to Dr. Nassar and didn't take it seriously. There were reports to police in a small town in Michigan, and they bought the explanation that it was legitimate medical procedure. There was a report in 2014 to a Title IX complaint to Michigan State University, and that was, again, explained as a legitimate medical procedure, but one of the people Michigan State University consulted for that was a doctor who was a protege and very close to Dr. Nassar.
He was abusing these girls. What exactly was he doing?
Well, I don't know how explicit you want to get, but it was using his ungloved fingers to penetrate, and under the guise of this being a legitimate medical procedure. And our understanding is that there is that type of procedure that is accepted, but it's very rare. And when you do it, the doctor's supposed to wear gloves. Nassar didn't wear gloves. You're supposed to have a chaperone in the room. He didn't do that. And if you're doing it to a minor, you sure as heck better get permission from their parents and explain to the minor what's about to happen. None of that None of that occurred.
It's understood that he was doing it for his own gratification.
Correct.
How many young women did he so abuse? I thought I saw somewhere there was at least 150 impact statements.
Right. After our first story, a woman named Rachel Den Hollander, very brave, came out by herself by name, Rachel Den Hollander from Louisville, Kentucky. After that story, it just snowballed. And yeah, now there are more than 150 people who have asked to speak at the sentencing hearing. And as one survivor victim said today, those are just the people who've chosen to come forward. How many more are there? Nobody knows.
Well, was it systematic? I mean, did he do this exam, if you will, to every single one of the women so that all of these gymnasts that I've seen waving to us on TV over the years for the United States, is it quite possible that he had abused all of them?
No. There were people who have said, including some of Simone Biles, the elite Olympic athlete, who said he hasn't, he did not abuse me. No, he did not abuse everyone, but he often he volunteered at a local gymnastics club every Monday night. Dr. Larry would come, and it was sort of he'd be alone with girls in a back room, and he would do his procedure. These were, it's hard to understand. They were, they were so young, and this was the great revered doctor who they were so lucky
right.
to be able to see.
Yeah,
and he
see
was
that.
From, he was at the Olympics, and he would give the.
How old are the girls we're talking
girls
about? How old are these young ladies we're talking about?
Well, as young as six, that, the, one of the first people to testify, for her, she was a family friend, and she babysat the kids, and it started when she was six. She was the only one that I know of so far who testified about something that was not under the guise of medical care.
How is it, though, you know, doesn't this sound a little bit like what happened to Penn State, or doesn't this sound like what happened in Hollywood with Harvey Weinstein? But you would think that these teenage girls would say, "Ooh, I hate that doctor. Why? Because I don't like the way he touches me." Oh, really? Me too. And that very quickly you would achieve critical mass and the sympathetic parents would go to bat for the kids. You know, how did it not snowball that way sooner?
No, yeah, first of all, like I said, there were instances where adults were told and they didn't do what they should have morally and as responsible adults. So maybe it could have been stopped. I know a lot of the survivors believe it could have been stopped. The best explanation is that even when people talk to each other, some of them said they didn't even really understand what was happening. They just knew they didn't like it. So they might have even been at an age where
mm-hmm.
they just didn't even understand sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And a lot of the survivors who are just coming forward this week said that they didn't, until our story came out and Rachel Den Hollander described what happened to her, they didn't really even to that day know that it was sexual abuse. It was to them, he was the great, kind, revered Dr. Nassar, the guy who carried Carrie Strug off the floor at the 1996 Olympics after her famous vault while she was injured.
Well, Michaela Maroney knew what was going on. So this is in the New York Times Sunday. An Olympic gold medalist said she signed a non-disclosure agreement in 2016. This is the New York Times reporting by the Wall Street Journal. It said she got $1.25 million from the Gymnastics Federation so as to be quiet about Dr. Nassar. Do you understand that to be true, and what do we make of that?
We have not on our end independently verified the payment, but what Maroney has said is that she was in a difficult financial position and in a difficult psychological position and needed help. And from the standpoint of USA Gymnastics, you know, and as you can probably imagine, gymnastics to the general public matters 1 week every 4 years. the Olympics. That's where they make their money. That's where kids get encouraged, to inspired to go sign up at gyms all over the country. They have to make that, that they wanted a clean run-up to Rio, and they paid her off.
The federation did, not the doctor, the federation. I mean,
No, right, USA Gymnastics.
But I mean,
right.
that's a whole nother level of complicity then, isn't it? I mean, I understand the doctor trying to hide his deeds, but how does the U.S. Olympic Federation not get involved in this on behalf of the girls? You've answered my question, but that doesn't make it okay. So what happens to those administrators in women's gymnastics?
Yeah. Well, there was fallout today, even. The top three members of the USA Gymnastics Board of Directors, the people responsible for the oversight of what's going on here at the Indianapolis headquarters and other places, resigned. And that was a big deal because the chairman, who had been there in his position of oversight for 18 years, just seemed to be taking a defiant stance to everything. But he's gone. The president of USA Gymnastics resigned last March. So there are some things happening, but to a lot of the survivors, victims, it's not enough yet.
Yeah, do we know much about the well-being of these young women? I guess there's so many of them, I'm asking a pretty broad brush question here, but
yeah,
how are they all doing?
Well, to see the sentencing hearing, person after person after person coming up and giving profoundly emotional testimony. A lot of the women said that being able to do that was helpful to them. It helped them heal. So for that, the judge's decision to let everyone speak seems quite reasonable.
Not to Dr. Nassar.
Having said that, no, he's right. He's sitting at the witness stand facing all of these women. But there were also lots of people crying and breaking down, and but many, they were able to gather the strength to even just show up in a place where they knew they were going to be on camera, and they knew that, as one of them said, the world is watching.
Well, we all have heard the stories about how if you want to be a great tennis player or golfer or gymnast or swimmer, you give your kids to that place in Florida or to that place in Arizona or California or Utah, and then they go take your little kid and they make them into this Olympic star or this world-class tennis player or golfer. And on some level, I think we've all kind of come to grips with that. I'm rethinking all of that now. The parents need to be more involved. There can never be private physical exams of these kids. I think there should be criminal punishment of the people who are in oversight positions and are negligent to that. How am I doing so far, Mark? What do you think?
Yeah, no, you're really well. I mean, the Caroli Ranch in Texas is the official, well, it was until last week, the official training center for the U.S. gymnastics.
Oh, yeah. They don't want to go there now.
They've closed that place.
Yeah.
So that that was a place where parents literally were not allowed.
Well, did Bella or his wife know about this?
Anywhere.
Did Bella or his wife know about this?
They are the subject of a civil lawsuit. They are named in one of the major civil lawsuits as being liable for what happened, because Larry was doing his thing sometimes in athletes' bedrooms with nobody else around. He was doing his
unbelievable
quote unquote therapy. Yeah, it's a very, very sad story, but inspiring in a way too, to see what they're calling themselves now, an army of survivors, and they are going to they have made their voices heard, and I think they're going to keep making their voices heard.
Well, we've seen how the women have rallied around one another that were abused or maltreated in Hollywood. But those were women who were in their late teens, early 20s, say 30s, who were being asked to do unspeakable things or just ridiculous things. But it's unspeakable that you would ask children in single digits or 12, 13, 14-year-olds to, put up with that. So it just strikes me as maybe, I don't know, maybe harder on their psyche. Maybe not. I don't know.
Well, I don't know either, but I do know that a lot of the women who were abused at a young age are now adults and have spoken out quite clearly about what they're feeling and what they think should happen with Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics. And like I said, a group really has formed, and a lot of people keep referring to themselves as part of an army.
Well, one last question. Go ahead, Mark. Finish that.
Oh, I was just going to say the first person you have, the clip you played before I came on of Kyle, one of her quotes that I even saw on a poster at the Women's March, just on a news report from over the weekend, but one of her quotes was, Larry, what you didn't understand is little girls become strong women.
Yeah.
Who can speak out and keep you in jail for 125 years, maybe.
It was hard for her parents to deal with that, though, wasn't it?
Yes. If I recall, she was the one whose father did not believe her, and it caused, over many years, and it caused strained relations and psychological damage, and it was just awful. But there's been story after story. Just when you think you've heard it all, something else comes up. And
I understand that he took his life too, really, her father. Yeah, it's 251.
Right.
Okay, well, so there is that story, and the only good about it will be if we alert ourselves to it and don't let something like this happen again. Writing about it in the Indianapolis Star, the series was called Out of Balance. Right? Are you continuing to write along these lines, Mark?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Out of Balance was the first story. It had nothing to do with Larry Nassar, the very first story in August of 2016. Because of that story, Rachel Den Hollander of Louisville got in touch with us and said, I'm not sure this pertains to your subject, but I want to tell you what happened with me and Larry Nassar. And
wow.
From there, it snowballed to where we are today.
As I like to say, if you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper. Mark Alicia writes for the Indianapolis Star. Speaking of our pictures, it's coming up on 3 o'clock. I'm getting my haircut at 3:30. Justin Kaufman's in with Anna DeVlantis.
Don't do that, man. Why are you getting a haircut?
Because I decided that my long, long hair has become my red Corvette. And I don't want
to. You're getting too much attention? I'm
looking a little desperate.
Are you driving around Gibson's in a circle on Friday nights? Has it gotten to that yet?
I don't want to be the guy who's like, look, I'm not that old. I've still got young hip hair.
Am I that guy?
No, you're not that guy. But then what do you do? You go like spiky and short? That doesn't seem
good. No, I'm just going to get it trimmed. I'm not going to get it.
I say you flaunt it. I say you keep going. I think you keep growing it out, get it to shoulder length, maybe a little longer.
Maybe do a man bun.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There you
could do the
hip.
Man
That's
bun.
Hip.
Good point.
I did that a few years ago just to show you that I'm not immune to stupidity. Like you don't know that already. What are you guys doing on your show today?
Oh, we've got so much. I just heard from Ro, by the way. He's in the rainforest and getting rained on. But when I saw hashtag rise up for Ro trending, I thought, are we worried? I mean, was something going on with poor Ro? And of course, I realized it's the
Wade,
Roe
right.
v. Wade 45th anniversary.
Oh, that Ro.
But it did concern me. And so he's okay.
Well,
he's
you know, Ro would be the kind of guy who goes, could you get another one of those wristbands for me? It's raining, and I don't like rain.
Right.
So.
Ro's strong. He's going to survive it, and I'm sure we'll tell us all about it.
Are we going to hear the president today?
I don't. If he speaks, I'm sure. But we'll obviously talk about the government shutdown. We'll talk about Illinois politics as the primary heats up. We'll talk about what we saw yesterday in football. Lots to talk about as Monday kicks off this tremendous news.
Yeah, Skilling's back too. He was on vacation for a while, so he'll tell us all about that. Tom Skilling, and we've got the Ben Bradley. Lou Kanellis will talk about the Super Bowl. Tom Brady does it again. And top five at five you won't believe.
Have a real good show. I know you will.
Thank you.